Now, the difficulty we face as Christians, or one of them, is that we want things to, when we have a sermon, when we're thinking about what is it all about, we either want things to be about now or about then. So we want things either to be about now, and we want things to be practical in whatever way we mean by that, or things are far off and it's all about the future. And there's a balance, isn't there? On the one hand, we need to have a wide angle and see God's eternal perspective that he's given us some degree of privy to. But that wide angle impacts everything now. So when we read the Bible, it changes us now. It's deeply practical in whatever it is that you do. But the perspective is also about then and this eternal perspective. And nowhere is that more true than the whole area of grief. And how do we handle losing someone very close to us? And I think we need teaching on it now before it is an issue you have to actually do. I guess most of us have had to face grief in one way or another in our life, but I was really struck by a comment a few years ago. There was an attack in a church in South Africa, and someone just walked into a church service, or a couple of people walked in, threw a couple of grenades and started shooting. And it was remarkable hearing how the church dealt with that. And the minister, a man called Frank Retief, said that what helped was the fact, it wasn't easy for them to deal with, but what helped enormously is that they'd thought about grief and pain and suffering before they had to deal with grief and pain and suffering. So it's worth from time to time us thinking about these things, and how does the Bible prepare us for that? And for some, well, all of us, I guess, that even the thought of losing some people in our lives makes us shudder, and it should. It's no bad thing you feel like that. And the answer, in part, of course, there's always more to it than just what I'm going to say now, is how Jesus carries you through that and walks through that with you. There's a pattern in Samuel that we've already seen, is that David is the Christ, the king. And although he's fallen, his life is a pattern for Jesus. So when we read about David, we see how David points us to Jesus. And so everything in David's life that we read about is relevant for the Christian. But when we read the Gospels, you might think, well, why don't we just go straight to the answer book and read the Gospels and don't bother with David? When we read the Gospels, David and others provides a background to Jesus and if you like, colour on the portrait and the significance of some of the things Jesus said and did. So he is the Christ and the King of the universe, and David sets this pattern for us. And there are three things we see here about David that point us towards Jesus. The three things are that he's the risen king, that he is the just king, and that he is the grieving king. And as you guess from what I said in the introduction, is we're going to be thinking about a pattern that we're given here for godly, good grief. But to establish that, we need to work through him as the risen king and the just king. And then we'll see him as the grieving king who walks with us. So the first thing is that he is the risen king in verses 1 and 2. On the third day. That's always a clue, isn't it? We've noticed in 1 Samuel already a few times we've had third days. And we said in 1 Corinthians 15, there's a creed given to us, and it says, Jesus rose on the third day in accordance with the scriptures. And it comes out in the Apostles and the Nicene Creed. Jesus rose on the third day in accordance with the scriptures. And what I think Paul means, and the councils that wrote the creeds, is more than just there's some prophecies about it. But there's a pattern of the third day that runs all the way through the scriptures. That resurrection and new life happens on the third day. So what we keep on seeing is something is going downhill and towards death. And then it's on the third day, it comes back up towards life and victory. So verse 1 is a summary and a contrast of the end of 1 Samuel 30 and 31. So Saul is dead. And David is at home, or he's exiled home in Ziklag after beating the Amalekites. So that's 30, David beats the Amalekites. 31, Saul is dead. And now he has to wait for 2 long days after his victory, 2 agonizing days, because he knew the Philistines, because we saw in chapter 29, we knew the Philistines were marching up against the Israelites, but he doesn't know how it's ended. 2 agonizing days before he gets the news. And we've said already, third days point to resurrection. And we think of the 2 days of, before Jesus' resurrection must have been agonizing. If you think of the disciples, Jesus dies, and of course at the resurrection they're perplexed at first and then they begin to understand. But 2 days before the resurrection, the agony, and the third day perplexing at first. So the third day, a man comes from Saul. And we know already from 1 Samuel that David is going to be king. That's God's plan. And that also his plan is that Saul be removed. And we've seen why that's the plan, is justice, that Saul is under God's curse and David is chosen in accordance with God's heart. So the first readers, the exiles, are asking, why are we here? What hope is there? And as we read this, we see, as they read this and as we read it, we see that they are the equivalent of Saul. They are cursed and God has dealt justly with them and exiled them. But they also see in David hope, that David has been, as we've thought already, he's been exiled from the land and he's now in Ziklag, where the Philistines are. So it's a sort of death for him, an exile and death, and this exile-death thing sort of intertwined throughout the Bible in the Old and New Testament. And so if you drew a chart of David's life, it goes down and down and down and down until this point. And then it comes on the third day, it then comes up as the path is open for him to return from exile and death back to the promised land and to be crowned. So the exile's hope is that they will return under a sort of King David, and from their current death to life, from exile to the promised land. And there's parallels here with Genesis as well, that we've seen this parallel running through 1 Samuel. There's a few Genesis parallels through, but there's a contrast between Benjamin and Judah. So Saul is a Benjamite, David is from Judah, as is Jesus. And what happens towards the end of Genesis is Joseph gives Benjamin this place of privilege in Egypt, like a king. But Jacob's, so you start thinking, oh, maybe if there's going to be some sort of nation, Benjamin will be the king. But Jacob's blessing is to Judah, that Judah's descendants will always rule Israel and be the king. And the difference between them is Benjamin is just declared in this position. Judah starts very badly, but he humbles himself and he's changed. And then he offers his life in the place of Benjamin. He's put himself in the position of death before he's pronounced as a king or the father of kings. Saul is just pronounced king, but David has to suffer and almost die and offer his life in the place of others. We saw earlier when he puts himself in the place of death and then he's raised to the throne. Well, how much more so is Judah and David's greater son, Jesus. So we often notice these parallels with Jesus and these people, but also between ourselves, between us and the exiles, that we are not in the promised land yet. Chelmsford's very nice, but it's not heaven. It's not the new creation, far from it. And so these exiles in Babylon, they are away from their promised land. They're away from the temple where they meet with God, and they would go to these synagogues. They couldn't get to the temple. They met together in synagogues around Babylon. And that's a pattern for the church. They had elders and they had a pattern of worship that's similar to our pattern of worship. And now we gather in these synagogues, in these churches around the world for worship and encouragement until the king comes home, or to take us home, rather. The king will come to us and take us back to the promised land, our future home. The king who was exiled in death, who risen to life, is going to take us from our exile to home with him. And that points us forward, of course, but as we look at 2 Samuel, it is about David. Before, it's right that we leap to Jesus, but also, what does it tell us about David? Well, David is a better kind of king than Saul. And so under David, Israel will fare much better than under Saul. But there's a problem. And this is, as I said about this chart, it's gone down, it now goes up. It will plateau and go back down, bit of a spoiler, as we go through to Samuel. But even in these next few chapters, we're going to find some problems for Israel, and they are David-induced, and we're meant to work that out. He has multiple wives, his failure to deal with Joab and his violence, and that causes problems right at the start. And there's a lesson there for leaders, and as we look at our leaders, a lesson in leadership that our moral failures, and if you have a human leader other than Jesus, they will have moral failures, and they will have lack of wisdom. So Joab's a lack of wisdom issue, having more than one wife is a moral issue. That has consequences that the rest of those who you lead will have to suffer for. That will always happen. But also gives us, as we look at David and his failings, because of what's right with him and what's wrong with him, we get a desire and a taste of the perfect king. And the second thing we see is the just king in verses 3 to 16. There's two versions of a saying in English. Crime doesn't pay, and who says crime doesn't pay? Two ways of the same sort of saying. The first is, look, don't do dishonest things because your crime will find you out. And the second one is, really, since when's that ever happened? It seems crime pays quite well. And we see those sides of the coin coming out here, that David is impartial and just. He doesn't seek vengeance, and yet he punishes crime, and that's his job. So verse 2, it says, behold, when we changed from NIV to ESV, that's one of the first things I noticed, is they keep on putting in behold, and it sounds a bit dated perhaps, but it sort of is often just a kind of flag up, pay attention, this bit you're meant to notice. And I think here, behold, it takes us to David's point of view. Behold, this is what David sees. As far as David can tell, we know, a bit more, as we'll see, but as far as David can see, this man comes from Saul in grief, and he has all the marks of grief. So he has dust on him, his clothes are torn, and he comes with information. And David takes it pretty much at face value. He does a bit of quizzing. And his conversation starts, and he starts interrogating, well, how do you know this? So David asks questions, and the man gives answers, and we start teasing out the information. And it's very reminiscent of 1 Samuel chapter 4, we looked at some time ago now. If you remember there, when the ark goes into battle and the sons of Eli die, and then a man comes from the battle to the town and then to Eli. And he reveals, and Eli has to coax what happens and then what happened, and we gradually coax the information out of him. And each time it's a bit worse than the time before. And the same happens here. The people fled. Many have fallen. Saul and Jonathan are dead. Now you may, if you've got a good memory, and you can remember things from a week ago, you may notice a contradiction. If anyone says to you, the problem with the Bible is there's so many contradictions, say to them, which three trouble you the most? I generally find that ends the conversation in a helpful way, not a bad way. That you may notice a contradiction. So in chapter 30, 1 Samuel 30, we saw Saul die. And this chapter opens, verse 1, after the death of Saul. So twice now we've said Saul dies. Now this man is saying that Saul was leaning on his spear, as good as dead, but begging to be finished off. And many try and harmonize this. And I've read some books during the week, and a few try and harmonize this, where they say, okay, so Saul asks his armor bearer to kill him, which we saw in chapter 30, and he refuses. And Saul falls on his sword. Notice that detail, sword, not spear. And the armor bearer then does the same. But what we don't know is that Saul is not quite dead yet, and then this man comes along and finishes him off. I think there's a little detail there that he leans on his spear. So we've seen him in a number of ways leaning on his spear. Ironically, that's how he's portrayed as dying here, is leaning on his spear. I don't think that's quite satisfactory, though, to harmonize this man's account with the account that the author of Samuel has given us. So this man, what the author here is giving us is reported speech. It's what the man said to David. What the writer of Samuel wanted you to see in chapter 30 and here is that Saul is dead. So that's what we see in chapter 2, verse 1, and in chapter 30, Saul is dead. And now this man's saying, I saw him asking to be killed. He wants you to notice that and feel that tension. Most likely, this man is lying. 1 Samuel 30, Israel fled. Those around Saul are dead. Where did this man come from? Now, David doesn't know this. This is a perspective that we have that David does not yet have. Now, why would this man do that? Well, he's found Saul. Maybe he's seen it at a distance. We know that people watch this from a distance. He's found Saul. He's taken the crown and the armband. They're the symbols of royalty. And let's have a look at how it pans out. The first thing he does is, having made himself look like he's mourning, he then comes and bows down. That's significant, isn't it? He bows down. He recognizes who David is. He's the risen king. He's exiled, but now he has this status. He's the Lord's anointed. He's going to return to the land and reign. He's the risen king. And he hands him the crown and the armband, the royal symbols that have gone from Saul to David. Now, David already has some royal symbols. He has the priest. He's eaten the holy bread. He's got the corner of Saul's robe he chopped off. He's got Goliath's swords. He's got He's got the emblems, the signs that he's the king. Now, why is this man doing this? Well, he thinks this is good news. King Saul has kept David off the throne. He's been trying to kill him. And his heir, Jonathan, are dead. So the throne is free for David. David benefits from this news, so surely he will reward the messenger who's bearing the royal symbols. But Saul's death is good news to the Philistines, we saw last week. In verse 11 to 12, it causes grief to David and his men. We'll come back to the grief in a moment. And so David asks in verse 13, where are you from? And as someone put it, this is the equivalent if you've been to the Scottish Highlands. You may have been asked, because you don't have a Highlands accent, you'd be asked, who are your people? They ask in the Highlands. You say, my people are the people of Essex, or something like that. And any other answer, they look at you sideways. Who are your people? And so he answers in verse 13. He says, I'm a sojourner, or the son of a sojourner, and a Amalekite. And those two details are significant. A sojourner is his status, and a Amalekite, if you like, is his ethnicity, for want of a better word. And both details are significant. So he's an Amalekite, that's his ethnicity. And there's an irony, again, in that. The Amalekites, to remind us, are God's enemies and Israel's enemies for a long time. In the Exodus, they're the ones that follow up from behind and attack the weak who are straggling at the back. It's a cowardly way of attacking them. And so God's judgment was meant to come through Saul, but this is Saul's failure. The Amalekites are the cause of Saul's downfall. The Amalekites are the reason why he doesn't have the throne, doesn't have the crown anymore. Saul lost the throne and God's blessing because of his sin to not deal with the Amalekites. And now the Amalekites have removed the crown and armband. And now an actual Amalekite has physically removed the crown and the armband and given it to David. So you see that the Amalekites are the reason that the throne is going to go from Saul to David. And it's an Amalekite, ironically, who takes those symbols off and gives them to David. Literally handing it to him. But also, as this Amalekite was handing the royal symbols, was removing the royal symbols from Saul's corpse. At the same time, because we remember 30 and 31 happens at the same time, David was routing the Amalekites. David was doing what Saul failed to do as an Amalekite takes the crown and the armband off of Saul's body. David took back what they stole, and Amalekite takes off the royal signs from Saul. So there's sort of this poetic irony that drives the point home of the difference between David and Saul. But also, he's the son of a sojourner. That's his status. So other versions have words like alien or foreigner, but it's a technical word that means something like resident alien. And we have a few sort of equivalents. who are here with us this evening. So you've got Jeremy, he's here on a work permit because we don't have enough engineers, so they want Jeremy to come here and say, you can come here and live here and pay your taxes, that would be great, and do the jobs that we're not skilled to do. And there's a few others of you here like that. So if you think of Charles, you think Charles is British until he tells you he's born in Zimbabwe, of Zimbabwean parents. The Hegels, two or three of them are born in Holland, one born here. You could say they are Dutch. But when you speak to them, they don't sound very Dutch, and they know our strange ways. That's the important thing, isn't it? That they get us. They get what British people are like, perhaps more than Dutch people. They're one of us. They're like us. And so this Amalekite, he's an Amalekite ethnically, but he lives in the land long term. In fact, he's the son of a sojourner. So his dad, an Amalekite, had this special status of living with God's people, and he's a son of a sojourner. So yes, he might look like an Amalekite. I don't know what they look like. He might look like an Amalekite, but he understands the way of Israel. He knows what they believe and how they behave and their values. And hence David's question in verse 14, David said to him, how is it you were not afraid to put out your hands to destroy the Lord's anointed? It'd be like saying to Charles or a Hegel, how did you know not to embarrass somebody? If you're British, you know that we don't do that. So he said, but this is much more serious. How did you not know? You live here. You know the culture. How did you think it was okay to lift your hand against the Lord's anointed? You'd know better. If he'd been a foreigner completely, then it's not right, but it's understandable. He wouldn't understand the values and stuff, but he does understand. And he has destroyed the Lord's anointed, the Christ. And all through the second half of 1 Samuel, we've seen David refuse to kill Saul or harm him. Saul is under God's judgment. David knows that. He's preventing David to come to the throne, which is God's will. And yet he would not lay a hand against him. He even experiences this guilt for chopping off a corner of his robe. And this man thought he was helping. He's claiming to have helped Saul. It's unlikely that that happened. He's claiming to have helped David, and he's probably trying to win favor because he knows David is now going to come back to reign, and he's trying to win favor with the new king. So verse 15, David called one of the young men and said, go execute him, and he struck him down so that he died. So the man's words condemn him. They're probably a lie as well. And that's a theme in Samuel, isn't it? That God sees, or we've got a perspective David doesn't have, and yet God sees. God sees this man's heart and his intentions. You may trick David, but you don't trick God. We can't catch God out on a technicality. It's reminiscent, isn't it, in Acts of Ananias and Sapphira and their deception of the apostles, but not of the Holy Spirit. Now, why would anyone sin and lie? In fact, more to the point, why would you sin and lie? And it's because of a perceived benefit. But God sees all, and he will judge by his Christ. Now, also, this passage stresses David's innocence. It has to be clear that David did not remove Saul, and he thinks that's a bad thing to do. And whoever did do it must pay. Psalm 2, we've sang earlier, reflects that. So although it's in God's sovereign hand, it must be clear that David's job is to not have a battle between Benjamin and Judah, but to unify Israel, and also that he is innocent. And of course, this points us to an important role of the Lord Jesus, is to unify his people and his innocence. So this man recognizes David as the king and the Christ, and bows down. But he bows down in self-interest, not in love. But the Christ will not reward the unrighteous. David is to administer justice to Israel, which points us forward to his greater son administering justice to the world. Now we have to establish all that he's the risen king and that he's the just king, in order to understand him as the grieving king. And we see that in verses 11 and 12, and we see it in the lament, verses 17 to 27. So far we've seen David as the risen king and the just king, and we've seen how that points us forward to Jesus as king, as the risen king and the just king. And we've needed to establish that to help us with our grief. And we see David now as the grieving king. And we see Jesus as the grieving king. So verse 11 to 12 is the priority of grief. And verses 17 to 27 is this structured lament. Now, it could be that verses 11 to 12 fit in between 10 and 13 where they're here, or after, because it would be a very long wait that the man's waiting while they go off and do this lamenting. But the first thing we see, what the writer wants to see straight away, is what is David's response and his men is grief. The grief can't wait. He wants to see the normalness, and maybe, for want of a better word, the goodness of grief. And then, in fact, we see it in Jesus, when he laments his friend. He doesn't sort of put it on the back burner. There and then, he expresses his grief. And then, verses 17 to 27, he's composed a lament. Now, that must take a bit of time to sit down, and it's very structured and thought through. It's a composed lament. And the reason, verse 18, it says, so that it can be taught to Israel. So grief, by design here, remembers. The lament is to remember the grief. And you may have heard something, maybe you've experienced the bereavement and someone has said something to you or about someone you know who's grieving. Why can't you get over it? Isn't it time to move on? Or something like that. And yes, you have to get on with life. Life carries on. It struck me, I remember when my dad died, of just looking out the window and just seeing it didn't bother anyone else because they wouldn't know. Why would they? Life goes on. But grief comes with us through life. And how you process grief is different for every occasion you have to do it. You just have to process it. And grief remembers. Grief stays with you. And that's not bad. And here we see two important things in the lament. First, the king grieves personally, but also he grieves in his role as king and instructs the people how to grieve. And so that is then the second thing, is then he shows us how to grieve healthily. This is teaching us how to grieve. And the striking thing about the lament is that if you did like a chart of all the types, there's lots of different types of psalms in the book of Psalms. The most common type of psalm? Lament. If we only sang laments, we'd have very gloomy services. It might not be good for you. If we never sung laments, we'd be trivial Christians. It's often criticised, isn't it, that the way evangelical churches sing is a little bit trivial, a bit Jesus, will you be my boyfriend, and a bit light in its content. If you go too far either way, you are unbalanced. But lament is there. And there's a reason why lament is there. We've got to grapple with lament. Now, it's worth noticing as well that 1 Samuel started with a song and 2 Samuel ends with a song. And in the middle is a song. So 1 Samuel, you have the birth of a key leader, Samuel, and then a song. 2 Samuel, leadership passes from Saul to David, and a song. And the book ends with a song. Now, this song doesn't mention God. God is not directly mentioned in chapter 1 at all, only indirectly as the Lord's anointed to Saul, or of Saul. But in this song, there are lots of echoes of Hannah's song at the beginning, which was saturated with God. And so we see the themes here, they're the same themes, that God is sovereign over them. Notice a footnote in verse 17. In our version, it says, David lamented with his lament. What else would you do with a lament? The actual word there is a bow. David lamented with the bow. Or better, bow is probably the title of the lament. And it mentions in the lament about David's weapon being the bow. And we've seen in 1 Samuel, Jonathan's favourite weapon is the bow. He's killed by a bow. And in Hannah's song, it talks about the mighty have their bows broken. So this is the lament of the bow. And verse 18, it's written in the book of Jasher, which we don't have. Jasher means the upright. So there's a contrast between Jonathan, the upright, and this Amalekite messenger. And the start of verse 19 says, your glory. Now, actually, it's another interesting thing there is that the word there for glory is an unusual word, which can also be translated gazelle. And I think it's a double meaning. So it can mean glory or gazelle. So it's a reference to Jonathan, who gazelle-like, silently on all fours, crept up on the Philistines in his finest hour when he had a great victory with his armor bearer. And so see how it starts and ends with this parallel. So verse 19, your glory or your gazelle, O Israel, is slain on your high places, how the mighty have fallen. Verse 25, how the mighty have fallen in the midst of battle. Jonathan lies slain on the high places. See, gazelle and Jonathan laying on the high places. The mighty have fallen. Jonathan the gazelle lies slain. And there's this clear structure that sort of works into a middle. The centre being about Jonathan and Saul, and then outside how the mighty have fallen, and sort of inside those about women. So a few times in 1 Samuel, women come out singing in praise for David or David and Saul. And in verse 20, the women of the Philistines are singing out about Saul's death. And David does not want them to. The Philistine women singing shames the memory of these warriors and of God's honour. And he wants the news not to go out, but it has. It's too late. And David laments it. And then verse 24, he calls the women or the daughters of Israel to weep and mourn. Before they cheered, now he wants them to mourn. He doesn't want the Philistines to cheer, but he wants the Israelites to weep. And at the centre, verses 21 to 23 is about Saul and Jonathan, who lie dead, despite their heroics. And verse 23 focuses on their character, the loved and the lovely. And the song carries on into verses 26 and 27 with a focus on Jonathan, surpassing the love of women. And apologies for having to mention it, but in a lot of scholars bring up their to show that they're gay. Notice in 1 Samuel, we noticed that that was raised as well, about their love for each other and some of the things that were mentioned about them. There's a large, I just remind you of what was said about them, is there's a large age gap between Jonathan and David, not that necessarily means it that much, but there's about a 30-year age gap we worked out, at least 20. And the relationship is covenantal. So some of the things that people latch onto are covenantal signs. For example, the kissing is a covenantal sign. The love word is a covenant. You love, the king demands love from his subjects and so on. Because what we would have expected otherwise is Jonathan as the heir for David to follow. Rather, it gets swapped that Jonathan, in faith, follows David and hands over his rights to David. And the love that surpasses women is not an unusual statement. It might be for us, but in 1 Samuel, and this is true of most of the world until about 120 or so years ago, certainly in this country, that marriage was much more practical. It doesn't mean there was never romance. We know the story of Romeo and Juliet, but romance existed, but it wasn't necessarily the biggest factor. Marriage was an incredibly practical thing. Also, warriors bond with their comrades, especially in ancient times. There was a very close bond. They did all sorts of rituals to develop that bond. And David refers to Jonathan as his brother. And of course, he was legally his brother-in-law, and they were covenantal brothers. So I think we can put that thing, that's not what it's about. But more obvious question that you might be asking, certainly my question as I come reading this, is how does Saul come out so well in this? He's not been crowned in glory in the last few chapters. Well, it's said, don't make ill of the dead. There's a time for historic and theological reflection, and we've had plenty of that in 1 Samuel, but now is the time for Israel to weep, including weeping what could have been, and a focus on what was good in his life. He did, on a number of occasions, save Israel and certain towns in Israel. And clearly here, Jonathan's life colours Saul's memory. It's very sad what was meant to be, but it's necessary. This lament is as David processes his grief and helps Israel process their grief. But it's a necessary stage to establish David as king. And already we've seen this program in Hannah's song at the beginning, which we've said is like a program for the books. God takes the mighty and brings them down, and the humble he brings up. But this lament is also a pattern for grief, to articulate what has happened and to invite others to join in and help them process the grief and to express the shame often their shame in grief, in verse 20, and to express sorrow and love. And lament forces you to work it through. So in verses 11 to 12 is the initial raw response, and verses 7 to 27 is a considered response. And there's a number of places where the Bible offers us patterns of healthy grief, itself very helpful. But we need to be a bit more than helpful, don't we? We need that helpful model. That's very pastorally useful. But we need more than a helpful model, don't we? King David's grief points us to Jesus' grief. Saul had established himself as David's enemy, and yet David grieves for him. The king does not rejoice over the death of his enemy. Jesus does not rejoice over the death of a sinner. For sure, Jesus, as David did, will judge the wicked. But he would rather forgive the repentant. Also, he has grief for a friend. We see how Jesus grieves for a friend. It's not the only time he does it, but the shortest verse in the Bible. Jesus wept. And if ever you read through John 11 and just chew it over a bit, it's a remarkable chapter. It starts with Jesus delaying his visit to Bethany, knowing that his delay will mean that Lazarus will die. He also knows that it will end with him raising him from the dead. Even so, he is moved to tears at his grave. Jesus cries. He weeps in sorrow over the death of his friend. And he goes on to groan with anger at his death. That Jesus is angry with death. And this is the Christian difference. We can have hopeful grief. And notice that they are both real. You can have real hope in your real grief. And you don't want to be fake about either. Non-Christians just don't have that. Now, in the last 17 years, I used to keep an Excel spreadsheet for this, but I've done over 100 funerals. I do so few now, I don't keep track. But I've done over 100 funerals. And very few of those have been for people I know and for people who I know to be Christians. So 90-plus funerals I've done are for unbelievers in unbelieving families. And I always sit with the family and talk to them about the funeral, and I share the gospel with them. I give them a booklet I've got about grief that's very good. And often there's numbness when a loved one dies. And that's understandable, and that happens with Christians too. Just this horrible numbness. And if you've experienced the death of a loved one, you know what I mean. Almost disbelief. But then the next thing is I notice two dominant responses, and sometimes both are in the room, sometimes just one. One is despair. People just go to pieces because they have no hope, because life is all there is, and now that has ended, and that is it. And they just cannot cope with it. And not only for their loved one, not only do they despair about that, but it reminds them that they're going to die, and the other people in the room are going to die, and there is no hope, and that life is pointless. That's one thing I've seen. The other one is just pretend. Nothing's happened. They've gone to the room next door. I sat with one family where they all went through what they thought had happened. And it was just, obviously it's not the time to say, have you worked out that none of those things can be true? Or only one of them can be true? Oh, they're in heaven now. And they go, oh, yes, he's with us now. Oh, yes, he's with so-and-so. He's going to be reincarnated. He's going to be there. And they're all going, oh, isn't it lovely? And you're going, how can it be all of those things? It doesn't make any sense. That's not the time for a logic class, I know, but I just observed it. And just this pretend, and that often people want to read a poem about how nothing has happened. There's a box in the ground. Your loved one is not breathing and is rotting. What do you mean nothing has happened? Something tremendously stressful and depressing and alarming has happened. To pretend is not healthy for you. And they can't handle the pain, so they either just go to pieces or they pretend the pain away or pretend for a bit. Only Christians can stand there and admit what has happened. Only Christians can stand in the real pain and taunt death, you've lost. And the reason is because, as we said last week from the Heidelberg Catechism, that in life and death, we belong to King Jesus. He's the risen King who's conquered death. He's the just King. He will right wrongs, he will judge the wicked, and he'll impute his righteousness and forgive the repentant. He's the grieving King that will stand with you. And you can have hope in the face of death, of yours and others, when you come and bow down before the just and risen King. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for the hope that you give us, that we can face reality. We can face pain because of the hope of the grieving King who stands and grieves with us and who's angry with death. And we ask that we'd recognize his kingship, that we might bow down before him. We ask in his name. Amen.